So here we come, another Dharma talk on this middle part of the Bliss Out Beyond Your Wildest Expectations retreat. It doesn't get better than this in samsara. But even though all the supporting conditions are really good, even though it's so peaceful, good food, a nice place to stay, and a happy teacher who tells you jokes, even though all the conditions are almost perfect, sometimes it's a lot of suffering, because now you've got no one to complain about, except you. You can't say, oh, it's the place, it's the food, it's the climate, it's the bed. You're in big trouble now. But why is it that even you have the most perfect conditions outside, still you can't enjoy yourself and find some peace? And you'd think that this is paradise. You don't have to get up early in the morning. You know, some of these retreats, they ring the bell at 4 o'clock. Or we had a Zen retreat here some time ago, they bang the drum. A big drum, and if you don't get up, they bang you. So here, no one bangs you at all. No gongs, only a small one, you can't hear that in your room. So this is just so nice. And if you can't relax here, where on earth in the world can you relax? Why can't people relax? A lot of time is because of fear. I'm going to talk today about hindrances. Now, not the normal hindrances. If you want to learn about the five hindrances, like karma, chanda, or sensory desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry and doubt, go and read the books. But these are the real hindrances. Number one, fear. Fear of letting go. Fear of relaxing. It's really strange for me, because I was brought up in a very positive home. In a poor house, but you know, we loved each other. And even then I went to Thailand. I got brainwashed in this positive self-image. And so, you know, I didn't mind sort of letting go. But you guys, sometimes you're afraid of letting go because you don't think you deserve it. It's fear of happiness and fear of freedom. You know the old story about these guys who've been in jail for so many years? Maybe 20, 30, 40 years. And they get so used to jail that when their parole comes up, when the people say you can go free, they don't want to walk free. They're afraid of freedom. They can't handle it. Now, that's one of the reasons why you can't bliss out. You're afraid of that freedom. It's quite understandable because it's the nature of our mind. We get used to things. We get conditioned. We just like what we know. And anything which we don't know, even if it is far less painful, we're afraid of. Many, many, many years ago, when there weren't many Western people teaching anything to do about meditation, many of the people who went to India or to Thailand to seek out the wisdom of the East came back with long hair, smoking pot and marijuana. They were weirdos. But every now and again they told some really interesting stories. And this guy was a guy called Baba Ram Dass. He got kicked out of Harvard University. And anyway, but he was a very brilliant guy, brilliant psychologist. And so he went over to India and met a guru and came back to spread things like meditation. And one of his students asked him, can you please come and visit my dad? He's very sick in hospital. He's in constant pain. No one could medicate him out of that pain. Can you do something, some chanting? So he agreed. And so a few days later, he rocked up in this hospital in New York or somewhere. And there was this redneck sort of American man in the bed, very happy to see his daughter, when he saw what came in afterwards. He said, "Who the heck is that?" And I said, "This is my guru, my master, come to do some chanting for you." "No way." So while he talked with his daughter, this guru, this Ram Dass guy, he didn't know what to do, so he decided to give the father a foot massage, you know, reflexology. And the guy let him do that because it felt good. But after a few minutes, all the pain went away. And he had an experience, freedom from pain like that, for days or weeks. And as soon as the pain went away, he shouted at this guru, "Get away from my feet!" Because he'd rather have the pain than try to figure out what this long-haired weirdo was doing to take the pain away. It's really strange. We'd rather have the known and suffer with the known than to have freedom with what we can't understand yet. And that is one of the troubles with meditation. Once you start getting free of, say, just thinking, you think this is weird. It doesn't feel right. So what happens? We go and put in another thought. Because we feel comfortable in the world of thinking. That's what we're used to. That's what we know. So if you try and stop all those thinking, it's weird. It's strange. So our job here, or my job, is to market silence. To give it such a good rap that when it comes, you buy into it. And when you buy into it, that's just enough to get you to taste silence. And after a while, wow, that really feels good. This is where insight helps your meditation practice. Insight is not thoughts and theories and philosophies. Insight is not being able to give one-liners which impress your friends over in a coffee shop. Insight is being able to see and experience a different way of looking. So you experience what it's like to be silent. And it's so rare in our world that anyone is silent. Most times you're not allowed to be silent. I travel around a lot. I love my silence. When I travel around, sometimes you're in airports. And I was very excited once when I saw that in most modern airports they have a prayer room. A place where you can just sit and be quiet and meditate, I thought. So the first and only time I went into one of these prayer rooms, I thought, wow, I can meditate now. And I'd only sat down for about 10 seconds. When I heard the sound, "Please do not leave baggage unattended. Paging passenger so-so-so-so. Announcing the delay of flight SQ225 to Perth," or whatever it was. And all, there was PA system all the time. And there was not a moment of silence in the quiet room. And so I thought, someone is missing the point here. Why is it so hard to find silence? And when we do find silence, why is it we always want to destroy it? Why? Because we're afraid of that quietness and that silence. Again, from my youth, you know, growing up in London, a very, very busy city. And sometimes you go to do some business in the city or buy something or go for some appointment and, oh, you know, you get a bit tired. And there was always these churches or cathedrals around the capital, these old ancient buildings. And when I got really stressed out, I would just go in one of those cathedrals or churches and just sit down and just relax and be quiet. And it was a wonderful resource. But then modern times came. PA systems came. And I remember the last time I went into, I think, Westminster Abbey, busy doing something or other, I'm just wandering like half an hour by myself in peace and quiet. And I used to go to that cathedral when I could, because it was just quiet, it was huge and peaceful. And as soon as I walked in, my heart dropped. I was so disappointed, because they had, just in the last couple of weeks, installed their PA system. And they were having either a constant sermon over the PA system, or announcements, and there was no peace at all anymore. For me, that was sacrilege. The most important thing about a holy place is its peace, is its silence. Simply so people can get used to peace. So they're not afraid of silence. So they can just learn how to be quiet and still. Even what I said last night about not speaking too much. If I said that on the first day, you'd all get stressed out, because what do you mean we can't speak to each other? That's like torture. That's what they do in concentration camps. That's what they do in school sometimes. And sometimes people get so afraid and tense with those rules. Now, after a few days, you're not afraid of not talking to each other. You can trust in that silence. You don't need to speak. I've often seen sort of these people who've been married for 30, 40, 50 years. They don't speak to each other. Not because they've had an argument, but because they know each other so well. They don't need to speak. They know what the other person wants or how they think. They just go in, around in their house in perfect peace and harmony, with an understanding which comes before you even need to talk. And that's a very beautiful sense of harmony there, where there's no need to say, "How are you?" Because you can just say that with your eyes. You can just wish a person well with your smile. You don't need to break into speech and destroy the beautiful quietness and silence. So once we start to value and appreciate silence, people stop talking so much. And that feels so beautiful. You know, when people speak, sometimes it puts you on edge, because you have to answer back without offending them. You've got to say the right thing. And sometimes you don't realize just how speech can be very confrontive and cause you a lot of stress. You may have been sick yesterday, and Ajahn Brahm comes along and said, "Are you feeling better today?" That's a very stressful question to ask a person. Because if you say, "No, I feel terrible," you feel so guilty that all these people have gone out of their way to help you and look after you, and you haven't done your part by getting better for them. So a lot of time, actually, people lie when you ask them, "How are you feeling today?" How many of you can really be honest when someone says, "How are you feeling?" and you say, "Bloody awful, terrible." And that's how you feel, but you don't want to say that because you don't like disappointing people. So what most people say, "Oh, not so bad," and that means awful. Or you say, "A little bit better today," which means just a smidgen better, but pretty much the same as the day before. Because you always want to bend the truth to please the person who's asking you these questions. And someone says good morning to you, you just had your worst meditation of the whole life. What are you going to do? Say, "Get out of here. What do you mean good morning? It's terrible. What's good about it?" So sometimes when you speak, it can be very, very confronting. Because someone has to answer. And they've got to choose. And sometimes it's hard to actually to be honest. But when you don't speak, you give a person the freedom. The freedom they don't need to stress their mind by thinking up an answer. And by trying to figure out how you can answer, sort of being polite, being respectful, but not hurting the other person. It stresses you. And after a while, when you develop the silence in speech, it gets so wonderful. You enjoy it so much. Sometimes we do this little trick. It's like a retreat trick, that we ask people to be quiet, and the silence grows and grows during the week. And then just the last couple of hours of the retreat, you know, you have lunch and then clean up and then you know, we do some sort of ceremony to finish a retreat. And I tell people, just before the final lunch, you can speak now. And I give them permission to talk to each other. And no one does. And it's wonderful, because what I'm teaching people, they're like, now you have the freedom to speak, but you don't want to. Why? And that little exercise proves to people how joyful it is just to live together in peace and quiet, not needing to say things to each other. Breaking that old social convention of having to say good morning to each other, how are you, good night, how are you doing, is everything okay? Breaking all those conventions by learning that you can live together with 60 other people in perfect peace, harmony and friendship without needing to move the mouth. It's a wonderful insight there. Which means that when you go home, you value silence much more than speech. You know what it's like? People speak so much. And what they speak is 99% rubbish. Which means that no one values what you say. You waste so much time and upset each other so much. So, with silence, we get this beautiful sense of outer peace. In the same way that we don't speak with our mouth, in exactly the same way we learn how to not to speak with our mind, how to keep the inner silence. There's not that much difference between outer silence and inner silence, because outer speech is just when everyone else can hear what you're saying. Inner speech is only when you can hear what you're saying. And maybe me. No, I don't do that. That would be invasion of privacy. But, anyway, what would I want to listen to what you guys think about anyway? That's like reading Pulp Fiction, like reading a bad novel. You do it once or twice and never again. I don't want to read your mind. It's terrible. But anyway, when you learn how to be still outside, it's pretty much the same technique to be still inside. You just hold your inner tongue and listen and be and feel. And that silence, not only is it very beautiful and full of happiness, it gives you this incredible insight into what's going on in your body, what's going on in your life, what's going on around you. Because when we think so much, we're actually blocking out life. We're not living in the world, we're living in our thoughts about the world. And they say the thoughts about the world are so much different than the real world. What you think this world is not what it is. This is one of my little demonstrations. Here we go. This is an exercise for you. What's this? What is it? A bottle. What else is it? Yeah, what else? Red plastic. Yeah, what else? Wait, what else? What else? Okay, you can keep on going for about 5 or 10 minutes, and then you'll soon run out of thinking. You haven't got any more words left. Then you can start to see the bottle, or whatever else it is. The way we're taught to perceive, from the time you were at school, your teacher showed you a cat, and said, cat, C-A-T. They showed you house, house. They showed you mummy, daddy. And you learn all of these words and thoughts, until you could not distinguish the word daddy from the real thing. And you lived in the world of thoughts and labels. But later on in life, you stopped thinking. And then you could see your real daddy. Not who you thought he was. You can see what this truly is. Not what you think it is. When all the labels disappear. And then you can actually see clearly. I'm saying this because there's a huge difference between reality and thinking. And in meditation, this is where we go. This beautiful silent world of feeling, of knowing, without giving anything a name. Who is this? It's not Ajahn Brahm. That's just a name. It's far deeper, far more profound than that. That's why when you give people a name and you think you know them, you're not aware anymore. You're not looking. You're not investigating. You're not going deeper. So in the silent mind, the whole world opens out to you. You see things you never expected to see. You feel far deeper. And you realize how much all these names and thoughts have blocked you from being. So we start to value the silence. And that is how we overcome the hindrance of think, 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 think. That's how we could, even when we're at work, we can just be in that silence. And of course, I'm a monk, so I practice that a lot. So for example, when you come for your interviews and you look at me, I'm not thinking. I'm being. By which I mean, I'm not thinking what I'm going to say to you or how I'm going to respond to your questions. You just totally have a quiet, still mind. And that's how you can feel what you're really asking. That's how you can know what the problem truly is. Not by listening to the words, but by listening with all your other senses as well. In silence, in peace. It's a wonderful way to relate to people because then you can go far deeper into them than other people can. Then you can really relate. So, at work, office, in your family life, if you can have more silence, then you can truly listen and feel and know. You become much wiser to yourself, to your parents, to your partner, to your children. You have far, far greater fun in life, simply because you're not putting thoughts between you and the person who's trying to communicate with you. Your life goes far smoother. And it feels more delightful. So by seeing the delight and the benefits, the sheer beauty in silence, silence begins to grow. Again, this forest in which we live, it's very silent, and times of night or times of day, there's hardly any noise at all. People who've come from Asia, great monks, have noticed that in Australia there's very little sound at night. In Asian jungles there's the sound of cicadas, there's all sorts of wildlife comes out at night, but not in the Australian bush. Sometimes it's almost perfectly quiet. And that stillness is delightful, rare, beautiful, and it excites, but not in the sense of disturbing you. It excites something deep within which venerates the beautiful silence. When you can resonate with that silence, it grows in you. You become more and more quiet. So when you sit down to meditate, you don't go thinking about things. Why spoil this sacred silence with all this rubbish? So when silence comes, you silently respond, wow. It's like someone's giving you the winning lottery ticket. You don't throw it away easily. When someone gives you a precious diamond, you cherish and care for it. You don't drop it simply because it's valuable to you. If you really valued that silence, the thoughts would never be able to take it away from you. In the same way that sometimes I've had some business to do in town and I've had to go in these shopping malls. I hate going in those shopping malls, but sometimes you've got no choice. I looked sometimes in these busy shopping malls and see the mother carrying the shopping basket in one hand and her baby in the other hand. And she's walking through these busy throngs of people. Never once have I seen that mother drop her baby on the floor. Never once have I seen a mother leave the baby in a shop somewhere and go home and think, my goodness, where did I leave baby? They don't do that. You know why? Because they cherish and value their kid. That's why they never lose it. If you cherished and valued silence even more than a child from your own flesh, how much would silence stay with you? I mentioned this in passing earlier. If you value silence, it grows. If you value thinking, that grows. Value silence. It makes you more successful, more wise, more healthy, and brings you far closer to enlightenment. Through meditation, I've often taught this. You never think your way to meditation. You never think, here I am, I'm at this stage, what should I do next? If you try that way of meditation, you just get yourself all stuffed up. You feel your way into meditation, using your emotions, especially your ability just to leave the fear of silence behind, to trust in that silence, to leave the fear of control aside, and trust in the letting go. It's an emotional skill to be able to trust. Those of you who've had successful relationships with a partner, how much you needed to trust that other person. And that was very scary. You put your deepest happiness in the hands of somebody else, knowing that they could hurt you so much more than anything else. But you trust them. And you give them that dangerous burden. It takes that degree of trust to have a full, deep relationship. It takes the same amount of trust to let go into meditation. Knowing that, my goodness, this sounds scary. Giving up total control. Surrendering to this whole process of meditation. Letting go, what would happen? Sometimes I describe it to people that you're driving in a busy traffic on some expressway in Singapore, and there's a monk who's telling you, take your hands off the steering wheel, take your feet off the pedals, and you're the driver. Think, don't be stupid, I'll crash! Take your hand off the steering wheel, take your feet off the pedals. And you do. And your car goes smoothly without you driving it. In fact, it goes far better. That's actually what it's like in meditation. Somebody gave me a great simile many, many years ago. And there's a simile which answered a question which was in the back of my mind, which I always wondered how this could happen. And they gave me the answer, and it also illustrated why letting go causes stillness in meditation. It was a simile of the birds. You've seen all the birds, you know, in this forest. If you go deep in the forest, there's many more birds. Over in Bodhinyan, there's heaps of little birds. Where do the birds go to sleep at night? They don't go and lie down in beds like you do. They actually sleep on the twigs and branches of the trees. Could you do that? Imagine you sitting on a branch on a windy night. The tree would go backwards and forwards. How on earth can you get any sleep? Holding on for grim life. But those birds do that every night. How can they relax and let go when they're perched so high on a swaying tree? This fellow he's actually a doctor. But, obviously he knew enough about biology, especially about birds. When the birds put their claws on a tree, the more they relax their muscles, the more the muscles close the claws. Because the fully relaxed state of a bird's claws is closed. So the more the bird relaxes, the more those claws grip onto the twig or onto the branch. If they tense up, their claws open. And that's why they keep falling off. The psychotic, stressed out birds always fall off. The ones which are really relaxed and cool and peaceful, they can stay on perfectly safe and have a deep sleep. The same with meditation. The more you put effort in, the more things open up in the sense you keep falling off things. But when you let go, you become more and more stable. You don't fall off anything when you let go. It's counterintuitive at first, because you think, a bird has to struggle to stay on. No, if it struggles, it falls off, relaxes, and it stays on. The same with silence or any other meditation object you have. The more you relax, the more you let go, the more stable you are. You don't fall off. And that overcomes your fear. I've got the breath at last. If I don't stay with this breath, if I don't put off effort, it's going to wander off again. And of course it does keep wandering off. Because you grasp, you put forth effort. Letting go causes the stillness. So let go of the fear. And you'll find, when I'm not afraid, I don't have to control. And stillness and peace, they just come. One of the reasons why we get so afraid is because we've stuffed up many times before. We've been punished. We've been told off. And that creates more fear. In these retreats which I lead, you never get punished. You never get report cards. Every time each one of you have come to an interview and you said, oh, I haven't meditated at all this whole retreat. I've been sneaking into the kitchen at midnight, making myself something to eat. I've been totally useless. No matter what you ever say in retreat, in the interviews, I always say, very good. Those of you who've been to my retreats many times, you know I keep on saying, very good. No matter so what, even, I've just been round to the huts and I've murdered the person in the next room to me. And I'll say, very good. Because I am not going to judge you. I'm going to accept you for who you are. And when you don't judge, when you have this beautiful sense of acceptance, it gets rid of all the fear. You know what it's like at work? You have to succeed. You've got a boss, you know, giving you assessments all the time. Have your sales gone up? You know, have you sort of been producing enough work in academia? How many more papers or conferences have you gone to this last year? You know, are you really worth us employing you? You know, that was what it was like at school. Sometimes in life you're worried about what your husband thinks about you. You know, he gives you performance assessment, usually in the negative. And we're always being tested. And we're always afraid of failure. So here there's no testing at all. So there's no fear. No matter what you do in this retreat, the door of my heart will always be open to you. Unconditional acceptance. With that degree of metta, wow, I don't need to work hard to be accepted. I'm pre-accepted. There's a tradition in Buddhism to ask forgiveness usually at the end of a retreat. So people come and they say, Ajahn Brahm, anything we've done by body and speech and mind which might have offended you, we ask forgiveness. For those of you who have done that ceremony before, I always give you forgiveness, but a special type of forgiveness in the three time zones. I do forgive you for everything you've ever done. And I forgive you for what you're doing now. And I forgive you for what you might ever do in the future, until the coming of Maitreya Buddha. You are pre-forgiven. You've got blank check. You can do whatever you like. And I do that, it's not so much as a joke. I make fun of these things, but there's something profound there. When you're accepted, and you can accept yourself all this fear business disappears. You can just be, you can relax, you don't need to strive. You're a little bird on a tree, you don't have to try so hard to cling on. So you relax and you find, wow, now I can cling on when I stop trying. Now I can meditate when I stop trying to meditate. Now I can be at peace when I just let peace be. And you get these incredible, powerful insights into how you meditate. You understand why some people find it so difficult to meditate when it's such an easy thing to do. Just like, you know, the mummy bird said, just let go, darling. You know, you're not going to fall off. Oh, I'm afraid. And the bird keeps on falling off. Get back on the twig again. Now look, let go. Just make peace. Be kind, be gentle, little bird. No, I might fall off. So it strives and its claws open up and it falls off again. That's like you meditating. So one day, be a little bird on a tree and totally let go. And you found, wow, now I don't fall off at all. I'm so still and stable. I can go to sleep at night totally safe with no fear because I know the power of this letting go. So you give up all this fear and with it all this control and with it all this judging. Years ago, somebody, they knew I was a scientist. And they was asking me about, you know, technology. They quoted this fellow called Lord Kelvin. For those of you who are engineers, you know that Lord Kelvin is known in science by the Kelvin scale of temperature. Starting at zero is absolute zero, -273 degrees centigrade. The Kelvin scale of temperature. He was an engineer. He was a scientist. He was also a philosopher. He was one of the founders of what we call today technology. Because he was said, if we want to control nature by building aircraft, cars, iPods, before we can actually create all this technology, we have to have clear measurements, accurate measurements first of all. Because when we can measure accurately, then we can control. The same was the reason why we take census figures, why we do surveys for politics, why we always measure things like temperature or whatever. Because once we measure, we can find out what's going on and fix it. So Kelvin said, once we can learn how to measure nature, then we can learn how to control her. And so the first parts of science were having like standard measurements, like the standard meter or standard weights or clocks which told accurate time. And once those basic measurements were there, then technology could take off. And once I heard that, of course, being a weirdo, I turned it on its head. I said, yes, how profound that statement is. If we want to control nature, we have to learn how to measure her first. What happens if we don't measure her? Then there's no way we can control her. Nature becomes free. The only way we can control someone else is by measuring them first. If we don't measure them, you're good, you're bad, we can't control them anymore. The only way we can control ourselves or our meditation is by measuring it first. And if you stop all this measuring of your mind, of yourself, you can't control. You have to let go. There's no other way. So, this other way of overcoming the hindrance of control is stop measuring. Stop all this distinction between this is a good meditation, a bad meditation. Stop all this distinction between I'm tired, I'm energized. Stop measuring yourself, for goodness sake. Because when you stop measuring, you let go. Unfortunately, we're taught so much to measure, to assess. We're given grades at school. You know, we measure things at work. We measure our partner in life. You know, you're beautiful, you're ugly. I'm going to go out with you. Not with you. No way. Whatever it is, all this measurement goes on and thereby with the control. But when you don't measure at all, especially don't measure yourself. That's what metta is all about. Metta, the door of my heart is open to me no matter who I am. No matter what I've done. No matter what I'm going to do, it's no measuring. So try that during this retreat today. Don't measure your meditation. Don't measure yourself. Don't measure your life. You're not a failure, you're not a success. You're not a good meditator, you're not a hopeless meditator. You're not peaceful, you're not agitated. Because you don't have any measure at all. That's spooky and scary at first. Because it's like you've got no place to hang anything on. You experience this great sense of emptiness and freedom. When you're not measuring anything. There's nothing to do, nowhere to go. You can't control, you can't crave, you can't desire. You can't do anything except just be and let go and find some peace at last in your meditation. I was fortunate to have a wise meditation teacher when I was at university. And one of the things he said, I'd always remember, and I thought one of the smartest and most helpful things I heard in my life as a meditator. He said, there is no such thing as a bad meditation. I said, you don't know what I get up to when I meditate. No, he meant something much deeper than that. There's no such thing as a bad meditation. And it was true. When I stopped calling it bad, actually most meditations, they were very nice, they were nice and peaceful. But when you stopped measuring them, no bad, no good, your meditation became so peaceful, so beautiful. So when you're meditating, don't think, what stage am I at? Don't do that. Just be peaceful. Allow the peace to grow. Don't keep on asking yourself, where am I? Because once you say where you are, the next question is, what do I have to do next? Once you measure, then you control. So in order to stay in this present moment and not to control, give up all measuring. When you give up all measuring, all good and bad, all black and white, all peace, all agitation, all of that stuff, then you become totally free. You let go, no control, and peace just comes. Because look, that's what meditation is like when it happens. Sometimes I call it like, you know, getting on Buddha Air. Buddha Air. It leaves from all airports, but has only got one destination. All planes on Buddha Air go to Nirvana. And that's what it's like, practicing on this path. You know, you check in, you go through the customs and immigration, you wait for boarding. But once you're on the plane and you've got your seat on Buddha Air, you don't have to do anything. If you're sort of going back home, you're going on Tiger Air or Thai Airways or SQ, once you're on the aircraft, do you actually do anything? Do you go up to the captain and say, can you please take a shortcut because I'm late today? Do you say, look, I've always wanted to see Borobudur, this great monument in Java. Can you just, you know, swoop by? Because it's on the way. We'd actually go over Java when you go from Perth to Singapore. Can you just go a bit lower so I could actually have a look? I've got my camera. Would you mind doing that, please? Because the captain just will, you won't get to the captain anyway, but they will not take any orders from you, no matter what you say. It doesn't have any effect at all. Just like on Buddha Air. Once you start meditating, you're boarded on Buddha Air. So shut up, sit down, and just enjoy the journey. Some of you, the way you meditate, besides some of these people who go on the aircraft, they create so much havoc on board, they get arrested at the final destination. So don't be like that. Just sit down and enjoy it. So when I go on Buddha Air, you just sit down, and you get, like on all aircraft, you get the in-flight service. Do you get in-flight service on Tiger Airways? Nothing at all. Buddha Air, you do. But it's not in-flight service, we call it insight service. So on Buddha Air, the insight service is, you're sitting down there, just making peace, being kind, being gentle. And this beautiful flight attendant comes up to you and says, sir, would you like some limiter? We've got these beautiful lights on offer today. Which one would you like? Would you like gold or deep blue or purple or brilliant white? Oh, brilliant white, that's my favourite, thank you very much. And I give this beautiful nimitta. Oh, that's really blissful. Buddha, and you're enjoying that. Well, you didn't ask for it. It just came, it was served to you, at your seat. You didn't even have to move or press any buttons, it's just there for you. And after enjoying the beautiful nimitta, the flight attendant comes back and says, did you enjoy that? So, yeah, very nice. Would you like jhanas? We've got first, second, third, fourth on offer, special. And said, well, yeah, the last time first jhana, that's very nice, but I feel like third jhana today, thank you very much. And so they give you third jhana. Oh, that's very, very nice. And later on in the flight, they come back again. You know, they're always coming up offering you drinks or offering you snacks or whatever. They come and say, it's a special, special today, stream winning. Would you like stream winning, sir? Okay, why not? And they give you all these amazing insights. This is what happens on Buddha Air, on this beautiful path. You don't do anything. You just sit there. And all these beautiful things, they come to you. If you get out of your seat and start running around, it never comes. I think I mentioned the first night, or first talk, that the story about how I got so much energy that when I helped these monks dyeing their robes and I sent them to have a rest and I looked after everything for them, you know, for one night. I remember also another time when they were making robes. And because they didn't sleep much, because they had to work so hard, they were actually allowed to have some tea or coffee. Usually we weren't allowed tea or coffee at all in those early years as a monk. But if you're working hard, yeah, we'd give you something. So these were my friends. And as I finished up, they said, we're going to be up all night, but look, if you want a cup of tea or coffee at 3 o'clock, come round and we'll give it to you. We won't tell the abbot, because, you know, I was a friend. So get, you know, a cup of tea, which was actually something really special. So I actually woke up about 2:50, and I said, should I go and get a cup of tea? And then I thought, that's craving. I shouldn't give in to craving. But you know, it's delicious, there's a cup of tea and it's so rare. I said, no, no, you're a monk, don't go. So I went. Only a young monk, it's craving, it's so hard to stop. So there I was, well, walking. And actually, on the way, I heard the 3 o'clock bell ding. And when I got to the dyeing shed where the tea was, all the monks had left. They'd finished. But it was still warm there, but I must have just missed them. So I thought, no, I've missed my cup of tea. So I went to the hall anyway and started meditating. It was very sleepy and tired. This was the hot weather. It's very hard to be alert when you've only had 3 or 4 hours sleep and it's, you know, the tropics and you're an English monk. You're not used to the heat. And after the morning meditation, the monk said, where were you at 3 o'clock? And I said, I was walking over to the dyeing shed to actually to get a cup of tea. He said, that was a stupid thing to do. We were bringing you a cup of tea. At 3 o'clock, they'd gone another path. We passed each other. If I'd let go of my craving, if I'd have just sat in my hut, I'd have got a cup of tea. They were bringing one to me, but they got there, my hut was vacant. I was going to them, and where they were, there'd no one there. And I thought, that's craving. When you go towards a cup of tea, you miss it. But if you just let it come to you, you get heaps and heaps of cups of tea. That's my life, it's true, isn't it? So, that tells you about what meditation is like. You strive, you crave, you go looking for things, and they never come. But you just sit there and wait, like on Buddha Air. Be patient, be kind, be gentle, and then it comes. But one of the last hindrances I'm going to talk about is impatience. How many days have gone? How many days are left? Almost halfway through. Come on, get your act together, you've been sleeping too much. And that's called impatience. Patience is of two sorts. This is great insight you get in meditation. What I call waiting in the future and waiting in the present. For most people, patience is waiting in the future. waiting for something to happen next, waiting for the big insight to come, waiting for the nimittas to come. You're waiting somewhere in the future. They never come that way. The other type of waiting is called waiting in the present. So you're not looking for anything to come. You're looking for what's already here. You're patiently waiting in the present moment. Sometimes I change the preposition to call it waiting on the present moment. Just like a waiter in a restaurant. That's why they're called a waiter. They wait on the present moment. So they've got this experience called now. That's your customer. You have to wait on the present moment. To be attentive, to be caring. To see when their plate is empty so you can take it away and give them the next course. To see when their glass is only half full. As a waiter, it's half empty, you have to fill it. So you're aware, alert, caring, waiting on the moment. Now that's the sort of patience which gives beautiful results. You're in the moment, waiting on it, caring for it, making peace with it. And of course, such a waiter gets a huge tip at the end of the meal. First jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. A tip from your customer, your client, your mind. But if you wait in the future, you're waiting for something to happen. Right, this is going to be the best meditation. No, that's in the future. You wait in this moment, where you are. Wait on it. And that's called real patience. Not waiting for something to come. For waiting on what's already arrived. And if you know the difference between those two, again, a big hindrance has disappeared. The hindrance of expectation. When you're expecting something, you're not attending on what you've already got. Always looking for what's coming next, rather than what's already arrived. Expectation is literally looking outside of you. Looking outside of this moment. That's what expectation means. It's ex outside. No spectre, Latin, looking. It's looking outside. So we don't look outside. We look inside. No expectation. Inspectation. Every time you expect something, you're not paying any attention on where you already are. And that becomes a huge hindrance for you. Especially those of you who've had good meditations in the past. When you've had the lights, when you've had the bliss, when you've had these weird, wonderful, peaceful, beautiful experiences. And you want them back so much. You've had some bliss. Gimme, gimme, gimme. I want more, more, more. And it's okay wanting more, but if you really want to get that bliss back again, if you really want to have peace and stillness, you have to give up that wanting. Because all those bliss states, all those beautiful lights, all that happiness, all that deep insights, they all come when you're not wanting, when you don't expect anything. Ask yourself when you had your best meditation. It came as a surprise. It came out of the blue. You never thought it was going to happen. Very often, people when they start meditation, they have these great experiences. You know why? Because they haven't got a clue what they're doing. When they don't know what they're doing, they don't do anything. That's why they get nice meditation. It's not beginner's luck. It's like a simple, easy beginner's mind. So see if you can recreate that simple beginner's mind. Just being in a moment, not knowing what to do, so you don't do anything. Not expecting anything, because you don't know what to expect. You've got no experience. So you're just watching what's going on now. Making peace, being kind, being still, waiting on the moment, not waiting for something to happen. then everything happens. You're letting go of thought, you're letting go of fear, letting go of expectation, letting go of control. You can't judge because you have no experience to judge, you don't know what you're doing. And that's why you let go. So these are hindrances, not as you've ever heard them before, extra ones, above and beyond the ordinary. But these are some of your major hindrances which stop you developing deep meditation. Understand those hindrances. Understanding them is all you need to do. They're not overcome through effort. They're overcome through wisdom. Wisdom power is far stronger than brute force. Brute force is like knocking your head against a brick wall. Does your meditation feel like that? Knocking your head against a brick wall again and again and again and again. Wisdom power is standing back a little bit and noticing there's a huge door just to the left, which you could have walked through any time, you stupid idiot. So wisdom power shows you the way through the wall rather than always having to bang your head against the wall. Not willpower, but wisdom power. So there you go, giving you every powerful teaching so that you can totally eradicate all your hindrances and get into the deepest, most powerful, most blissful meditations whenever you want. All supplied on Buddha Air, taking off from Jhana Grove Meditation Retreat Center every moment of today. Please enjoy the flight. Any questions? Oh yeah, we've got a question down here. Go on. Go on, yeah. Correct. Yes, because all the jhanas are just stages of letting go, stages of peace and stillness. Anapanasati is fine, but these days I think it's a bit overused, so the people actually try and control the breath rather than just letting the breath come and letting the breath be a beautiful vehicle to let go of the body and develop the mind. But as I've often said, it's not what you watch. The object of the meditation is nowhere near as important as how you're watching it. So if you grasp the breath, and look, sometimes people have got strong willpower. They can watch the breath for a whole hour without losing one breath, and they end up tense with a headache. You can do that because you're exercising willpower, and it's so hard. And the other way, the way of the Buddha, is just you let go and the breath comes to you, and it's just there. You don't have to work at all. So peaceful, so beautiful, because you're enjoying it. It stays. That's the way of Buddhist meditation. A beautiful letting go. You try both. You can waste a lot of time with striving. As you should understand, striving, where does it come from? And what does it generate? It comes from the sense of ego, me trying to attain something. And it just makes the sense of self stronger. And it goes against the idea of dismantling our idea of self, letting it disappear, and becoming enlightened. People who struggle hard usually get very tense. They're usually very angry people, because they're control freaks. Yeah, they can sit still for maybe many hours, but only by willpower. And they get very strong egos. Letting go, being peaceful. You get in the deepest of meditations, have huge amounts of metta. You don't try and control anybody, let alone yourself. You're free. The object is not important.
You mentioned in a past retreat that the breath is the best vehicle and the best way to let go of the body. Can you clarify that?
breath is the best way to let go of the body, because when you are still, things disappear. That's one of the underlying laws of meditation. When things aren't moving, such as, I was saying this in the interview period, it was the sound of a refrigerator just next to my room is always very, very, it's actually quite a loud noise, but it doesn't change very much all day or night. So after a while you can't notice it anymore. Because the brain only notices things which change. You know, it's the temperature here. If it got hot, if it got colder, you would notice it. You got this taste of your saliva in your throat. Because it doesn't change, the mind doesn't notice it anymore. The brain is only wired to notice things which change. So when you close your eyes, you see blackness. Close your eyes now, see it's black. After a few seconds, because that blackness doesn't change, sight turns off. We try and keep it reasonably quiet. You don't need to be totally quiet. You can have the hum of traffic in the background. As long as it doesn't change, you stop hearing. Because the brain turns off. If you sit still, you're not moving your body. Because the feelings in the body don't change, the body disappears. You can't feel it anymore. The brain doesn't notice what doesn't move. As most of the body disappears, sight turned off, sound turned off, smell. As long as people haven't been eating too many baked beans and the smell doesn't suddenly change next to you. Somebody's shaking their head. Okay, I'm gross, that's who I am. Then sense of smell disappears. And bodily sensation is the hardest, or one of the hardest, with sound. So once most of the body has disappeared, what's left, what's moving, is either your breathing or your heartbeat. That's what's left. That's the only thing moving. So that's the only thing the mind pays attention to. The heartbeat is, you know, very, very hard to quieten down. And it's, you know, it's really irritating. So I tell people, someone's already asked that question, if the heartbeat comes up, just substitute it by going to the breathing. Just turn away and put the breath in the center. So you don't feel the heartbeat, which is unpleasant. You just notice the breath, which is far more pleasant. And when you're noticing the breath, it gets calmer and calmer and calmer. And it becomes this smooth breath. It's what happens when you follow the breath. In other words, it's just the breath is there. Yeah, you know the in-breath, out-breath at first, but then after a while you can't distinguish an in-breath and an out-breath. They all seem to merge together. It's just breath. You can't even notice the beginning and the end. It's just breath, that's all. You get this feeling of the breath, smooth, even, unchanging. Because it's unchanging, it disappears. And with it, your whole body is gone. You can't feel a thing anymore. So your sense of touch has finally turned off. Because of stillness, these things turn off. So the reason why the breath is useful, because it's a great way to make that transition from feeling everything in the body to feeling the breath and then feeling nothing at all. From many to one to none. And when your body disappears, oh, what a relief that is. I don't know about your body. My body, I've always got an itchy nose. You've got an ache here. You want to go to the toilet. You want to get a drink. You want to scratch something. This body is always asking me to do something. It never leaves me alone for a second. If you want to prove that, just look around. You just moved your hands. You're just banging your knee. You just moved your head up. You just turned your arms around. You just changed your position on your suit. You are just doing your clothes. We're always moving, doing something. Why? Because our body is always uncomfortable. If it was comfortable, you could leave it alone. But because we always have to do something, it shows you how unpleasant this body is. But we've got used to it, we don't notice it anymore. But when your body disappears, it doesn't ask anything of you. You're just sitting there. It's the most comfortable you've ever felt in your whole life. More comfortable than when you first wake up in the morning, cozy in your bed. Here is no feelings at all. And that is one of the first states of bliss. You're free from this very irritating body. And you realize how irritating it was once it disappears. It's like you've been carrying these big heavy burdens and now you put them down for the first time. Oh. I know some people have said, I've read in medical journals, they've had these migraines constant for year after year after year. They get used to it. And then some great medical technique comes and they give them this magic bullet, either the realigning their spine or giving them some drug. And for the first time in years, they don't feel pain. Oh, they get blissed out, it's euphoria. That's just like when your body disappears. So this is where we get blissed out, the first state of bliss. Can't feel your body, it's so peaceful, it's so wonderful. And that shows you the insight, what the Buddha said, this body is dukkha. Not being attached to the body, but having a body. Even a healthy one, let alone a sick one. So once it's gone, that feels nice. That gives you great insight. And that's why the breath is helpful there, because it is a natural transition. A lot of time it happens naturally, whether you ask for it or not. Things quiet down, the breath comes up, because that's the only thing moving. And it quiets down, quiets down, quiets down, becomes so still it disappears. And then you're in the realm of the mind, the nimittas and the jhanas. Have a wonderful time. A holiday. A real vacation from your body. Same thing happens when you die. You leave your body. People who come back after their near-death experiences, you know, Professor Pim Van Rommel and all these other people who collected all this great information about people who have these NDEs. Invariably, people who die and leave their bodies feel so pleasant, so beautiful. The most pleasant experience they've ever had. Why? Because they're free of their body. Has anyone here had a near-death experience? Floating out of the body? If you've had, I think you can confirm, it's very, very pleasant. One of the stories which I read, and I collect the funny ones. This lady was, I think she was having an operation, and you know, something went wrong, she died on the operating table, she was floating out. Oh, and it was wonderful! Really having a lot of bliss and a lot of happiness. And then she met this spirit guide or something who said, no, it's not your time to die yet, you've got to go back. That's not very common. Most people have NDEs, they meet someone who says, no, you've got to go back. But this lady, I think she was Australian, she said, no, I don't want to go back. And the spirit said, you have to. Into that old body, no way. I'm having such a wonderful time. It felt so blissful, she was free. And had this argument with the spirit, you've got to go back, I don't want to, you have to, I will not. And then while she was arguing, the spirit got hold of her and actually threw her back into her body. And she was really fed up. And when she was being interviewed, she said, when I die next time, really die, I'm going to find that spirit and I'm going to scold him, I'm going to tell him off what he did to me, I will never forgive him. It's really funny that, you know, she's enjoying herself so much. And while she wasn't paying attention, the argument with this guy, this spirit guy threw her back into her old body. Thank you very much. That's how pleasant it is to die. And if you want to prove that before you're actually physically dead, get into deep meditation. It's very similar. You're letting go of your five senses. You're just going to this deep state of peace and bliss. Wow. Wonderful. So you can check it out to see before you actually die. That's why oftentimes I call meditation sort of learning how to die. It's like dying training. So this is a dying camp. You've got to do it, you might as well learn how to do it well. So, that didn't really answer your question, that was another talk, wasn't it? I think you're quite happy. Any other question? Going. Go on. Okay. So, have a nice morning and see if you can die to your body and bliss out. Remember, no judging. Remember, no fear. Remember, when you let go like a bird, you're going to stay still. You don't have to worry about anything. And what else did I talk about? Patience, that's right. Waiting in the moment. Don't wait in the future. And then all the hindrances, oh, and thinking. The silence is far more valuable. So really get into the silence. And the thinking won't come up. Because thinking stuff is rubbish. I just want to be silent. That's much nicer. Okay, have a great time. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Great. Okay, interviews, for those who want interviews.